Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, a show written and produced for Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire is produced by the CKUT News Collective in Montreal, Quebec. We'll be your hosts for the show. I'm Leanne Arneson.
And I'm Carla Green.
In this edition,
there is no mitigating for the damage that a 6,000-bed ski city would cause to the grizzly bear population.
These attacks on abortion access and on women's rights, they kind of divert from the real issue.
It's real. I mean, and if you're not being forced to choose between work and school, then you're taking on more debt.
But first, here's the national news.
The 16th annual International Day Against Police Brutality took place again this year on March 15th and saw over 4,000 protesters take to the streets of Montreal for a lively demonstration organized by the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality. The protest drew particularly large numbers this year, as hundreds of thousands of students in Quebec are also on strike, and numerous student actions had been violently repressed by police in recent weeks. Many students who turned up to the anti-police brutality demo wore red patches on their eyes in solidarity with college student Francis Grenier, whose eye was severely injured by a police flash grenade at a demo in Montreal on March 7th. Grenier may not regain vision in his injured eye. The demonstration saw predictable rioting from participants, as well as predictable violence from police, who used more flash grenades, pepper spray, tear gas, and batons against the crowds. By the end of the march, Montreal police had announced 226 people had been arrested, with most being served tickets for municipal bylaw infractions. The collective who organized the march plans to contest all tickets in court. For CKUT Radio in Montreal, this is Aaron Lakoff.
The Plan Nord is a mega project of mines, hydro dams, roads, and much more that will further colonize, exploit, and destroy the lands and the land-based communities. The Plan Nord take place in a long history of colonization, genocide, and ecocide. We'll listen voices of the opposition. We'll learn more about the growing opposition from an interview with Dan of the anti-colonial collective based in Sault Ste. Montreal, made by Elizabeth Fox, an intern with the CKUT News Collective, reporting about a demo March 13th in support of a blockade made by the Inuits of the Road 138 from March 5th to March 9th. Against the encroaching of Hydro-Québec building power lines in their territory without their consent. This report was made by Chris, member of the News Collective at CKUT, and one of the producers of Native Solidarity News for Groundwire.
The Plan Nord is a continuation, I guess. I'd say the Paix des Braves was the door opening a little bit to the possibility, and now the door is swinging wide open with the Plan Nord for occupation and ultimately the assimilation of Aboriginal people in Northern Quebec.
I'm Dan. I'm part of the Anti-Colonial Solidarity Collective, and we helped organize this demo in solidarity with the blockade that happened on the Highway 138 just outside of Maniutinam, which is an Innu reserve near Sept-Îles. And so the blockade lasted all week last week. It started on Monday, and then it was eventually broken up by the SQ after Hydro-Québec filed an injunction. And what they were doing is they were trying to blockade the highway in order to prevent trucks from going to work on the Remain Hydro project, where various blockades were being built, but also transmission lines were being put through their territory. And so they stayed there to resist the construction of those hydroelectric lines and to defend their territories and their autonomy. They weren't consulted. And then so the SQ came, broke up the blockade. There were 13 arrests with the criminal charges pending. And then there were solidarity blockades as well in Passamit, further on the same road, on the 138. And so we're here to have a demonstration in solidarity with the Innu people that are resisting and show that we support their struggle and that we are also here to struggle against the Plan Nord and other capitalist and colonialist development projects that are destroying the earth and our communities.
If you want to know more about the Plan Nord and its opposition, you can go on montreal.musicohub.ca. You can also go on Innu Power, on one word, on Facebook.
Now it's time for our feature stories. Many in southeastern BC oppose the construction of a 6,000-hectare year-round ski resort on Jumbo Glacier, even though the resort was just given the green light by the BC government. Catherine Fisher brings us this story.
I'm really disappointed that the government has denied the public and us respect.
That's Marilyn James, appointed spokesperson of Sinaiks Nation. Marilyn is speaking about the Jumbo Glacier Resort development, which has just received approval from the BC government. The Sinaiks, like a large segment of the population in the region, have opposed the building of this resort for many years. The ski resort and recreational city is planned to be built on and around Jumbo Glacier in the Purcell Mountains. The proposed resort would feature up to 23 ski lifts and more than 6,000 beds. The whole development is expected to cover more than 6,000 hectares. The project's effect on the local grizzly bear and wolverine populations has been a major cause for concern among scientists, environmentalists, and First Nations people. The proponent, Glacier Resorts Limited, received an environmental assessment certificate for the resort. This included 195 commitments to mitigate environmental impacts. Glacier Resorts states on their website that a near no net impact on the grizzly bear population may be achieved. The Sinaiks don't agree.
Development in this regard has never worked in the past. Show me one development that has created sustainability for wildlife.
Kaylin DeKeevy of the West Kootenay Coalition for Jumbo Wild also disagrees with the proponent's statement.
There is no mitigating for the damage that a 6,000-bed ski city would cause to the grizzly bear population. This area is a core source of sustenance for grizzly bears in this region. In fact, the United States are trying to lure grizzly bears back into their territory from this source population. There are parcels of land being bought up to facilitate the movement of bears to expand their territory back into the U.S. from the Purcells.
David Reed, executive director of the West Kootenay Eco Society, elaborates on the importance of this area to the bears.
It's not just 50 kilometers from Invermere, it's literally right next door to the Purcell Wilderness Conservancy. So it's part of what's envisioned as a huge wildlife corridor called the Yukon to Yellowstone Wildlife Corridor. So that area is the mothership of grizzly populations.
Wildlife habitat is a major concern to those opposed to the project, but it isn't the only one. Marilyn James.
If we affect what's on the top, we affect everything below that point, water quality or habitat or other kinds of issues. Those principles, those laws that we talk about under our Whiplock'n, which is the law of the land here within our territory, and Smamim are ways of being in community that create value and equity for every single person who is involved in that community. Water quality isn't just water quality for Indians. It's water quality from the tops of these mountains here all the way down. And it's water quality for not just human beings, but all the other flora and fauna that require that as part of their environment.
The announcement of the approval of the Master Development Agreement allowing Jumbo Resort to be built happened in Victoria, BC. David Reed thinks he knows why.
I think if it had been announced somewhere in the Kootenays, you would have, if they had said, oh, at 11 o'clock, we're going to have a press conference to announce that Jumbo is going to be passed, you would have had hundreds, if not thousands, of protesters at that meeting or at that press conference at 11 o'clock, even on just an hour's notice. You will see opposition on the ground. There will be a blockade. There will be most likely legal challenges. So this is far from over.
Kaylin DeKeevy agrees this isn't over.
The provincial government, with their announcement this week, has bought into many, many years of problems for themselves.
This is Catherine Fisher reporting from CJLY on Sinaiks traditional territory in Nelson, BC. Thanks to Chad Hansen and Kootenay Morning for files.
Director and producer of Radio Resistencia, Felix Melina, has been providing a voice for the resistance movement in Honduras since the 2009 coup d'etat. This month, Mr. Molina was touring Canada in order to spread the word about the human rights violations in Honduras and Canada's role in supporting the coup d'etat. Jen Beaver brings us an interview in Ottawa with Mr. Molina.
In 2009, in Honduras, there was a coup against democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. Since the coup, almost every section of society has experienced human rights violations. Women, lesbian and gay communities, campesinos, teachers, students, journalists, and many others involved in the resistance have faced death threats, assassinations, and legal oppression. There has been growing fear of the police and military as mounting evidence points to their complicit participation in these human rights violations. Felix Molina, a well-known Honduran journalist and producer of Radio Resistencia, has been providing a voice for those opposed to the current regime. I had the opportunity to speak with Felix about Canada's complicity in the coup in order to support Canadian mining interests in Honduras. The current Honduran government has been working to pass a new mining law that would connect Canada and Honduras. This mining law is like a hurricane. To use Naomi Klein's words, it is like a shock therapy. The first mining law was passed after Hurricane Mitch in 1989, but now this is a new political hurricane. And under this political hurricane, a second mining law is being passed. This mining law only helps the interests of Canadian mining companies like Goldcorp and other mineral corporations. There has been a lot of lobbying from the Canadian government and Canadian mining companies to pass this law. Canadian and U.S. interest in mining law began even before the coup. President Zelaya, from the first day of his presidency, said that he would not give any more concessions to open-pit mining. Canada never condemned the coup d'etat. When Zelaya tried to go back a week after the coup, Canada was the only country that opposed his return. Following the coup, Canada signed a free trade agreement with Honduras. People in Canada and Honduras have no idea what is written in this agreement. The free trade agreement was signed in the second largest city in Honduras and not in the capital, Tegucigalpa, where it normally would be. Since the free trade agreement, there has been a lot of lobbying from the Canadian government and companies to pass this mining law. In his final comments, Felix added that 2% of mining company profits will go towards security, thus going towards the police that nobody trusts, and the army as well. Mining company profits will be used to empower the police. Finally, there has been lobbying to include corporate social responsibility in this new mining law. Under this, corporations are expected to police themselves. This would mean that displacement, environmental destruction, human rights violations, water contamination, and associated health problems would go unchecked. This is Jen Bieber reporting out of Montreal. For more information on Canadian mining in Central America, visit the Social Justice Committee website at s-j-c.net.
It's time now for a short music break. Groundwire will be right back.
Riding my bike right around the neighborhood. Letting my feet do what I know.
To mark International Women's Day earlier this month, protesters came together outside of a prominent Montreal abortion clinic. They were there to counter a group that they call anti-choice, which has been there for several weeks already. Trevor Chow Fraser from CFRU-FM gathered these voices from the scene.
We're mostly, So I'm in Montreal, and I'm standing on the corner of Saint-Joseph, and there's a double demonstration going on. There's a couple banners up saying, pray to end abortion. And then there's a group of young people with signs standing in front of them. And their signs say things like, mon corps, mon choix, pro-choix.
Yes, hi. I'm Claudine Jarre. I'm here to defend a woman's right to choose. Well, it's very informal. A lot of the activism has been done on Facebook. That's how I became aware of it. But we're not a coordinated group, so it's just a bunch of women who decided to come here and come together with signs and songs, and sometimes we had music. And we're all here to protest on Women's Day. So, nice action to do for Women's Day.
Sure. My name is Brian Jenkins. I'm the coordinator of this prayer vigil. It's called 40 Days for Life. Previous pro-choice people always gathered on the other side of the of this divide, this boundary between the two grounds, the two knolls. So it's odd that today they've come and stood in front of the banner. So.
Tu parles en anglais? They just want us to move because they say we're hiding their banner. But I told them like it's also we're in front of an abortion clinic, so we're just asking like them because they're doing intimidation to the women that go there and. Like they're going to get an abortion and they're praying for the end of it. My name is Maxine. I'm studying at UCAM in feminist studies. This is important to me because, well, I work in an abortion clinic. And I think that freedom of choice, it's like the base of society. And right now it's endangered. Like abortion, it's not, I don't know how you say that, but acquis. Sometimes we feel that it's like normal and we can have it anytime, but it's always in danger. And it's only been 20 years that it's like legal abortion and 3 years that you can get it done for free. Yeah, that's it.
And can you talk about why you feel it's important to demonstrate against abortion?
In a nutshell, it's the life of the unborn. I think it's a justice issue. Every life has the right to live, and the unborn can't speak for him or herself. So I personally respect the woman's choice over matters regarding herself, whether it be a kidney transplant or other things, except in the case of the fetus. The fetus is a separate entity. It has its own genetic identity, different from the mother's. So it's not really her body. There's another body that's growing inside of her. And it's that child that's dear to many of us, myself included, and that we want to be here and to change hearts and change minds in that respect.
These attacks on abortion access and on women's rights, they kind of divert from the real issue, which is how can we make unwanted pregnancies rarer? How can we raise awareness about safe sex? How can we have good sex educations in general? Quebec has decided not to have any more sex education in schools, which is not very good for young teenagers to be responsible about sex and about their sexuality. So really, whenever we have to be here to defend our rights, it diverts away from the real issue is how can we change things to actually make the need for abortion rarer.
For Groundwire National News, I'm Trevor Chow Fraser in Montreal on International Women's Day.
There are currently more than 200,000 students in Quebec's cégeps, colleges, and universities on strike. This strike is in opposition to the Sherrick government's budget that would increase the cost of tuition in Quebec significantly starting September 2012. The wave of support for this student strike movement has been growing enormously since mid-February of this year and has initiated some of Quebec's largest demonstrations. David Tassium has this story.
Okay, how many of you are here from Concordia today?
How many would you say, Let?
Probably, I don't know, 50, 60 Concordia students, but we're on reading week right now, so that's why it's such a small number. But the actual number about the dropout rates is between 7 and 30,000 people by 2017. So, I mean, it's massive. Like, that's the entire population of Concordia and dropouts. It's real. I mean, and if you're not being forced to choose between work and school, then you're taking on more debt. You're spending more time, you know, at work trying to pay off bills. And the reality is that the financial aid system is completely inadequate to deal with the realities of student debt. Like, you know, there are assumptions like that internet access is a luxury, that transportation costs are far lower than they are. You know, that people can survive on $7 a day in food and basic services. It's not just. It's not justifiable.
Do you see this strike as growing in numbers over the next weeks?
Huge. Yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised at how big it is already. But yeah, you're going to see the numbers probably doubling each week.
It's not going to stop.
Oh, no, no. No, no, it's just starting.
Prions plus fort pour que personne ne nous ignore. Cry out louder so that no one ignores us.
What's different about this one today, Tuesday the 13th?
Well, I think that it's not only this protest, but the general movement is quite big, and especially the support from the teachers, I think, is exceptional, and even more than in 2005. Teachers are more mobilized, and I think that in general, we have to see that this is really a do-or-die movement, and the students know it, and they're not ready to let the public education system go without a fight. Now, the challenge today is to show that this fight is not only a local fight, but it's an international fight, and also a fight for the families and the workers, not just the students, because the debt will go on the students and on their parents also. So we are fighting today and marching to show that it's not only a student cause. It's a cause of solidarity of all the people. It's an internationalist fight, I think. And the first lady was speaking very beautifully with a Spanish accent. I'm not sure where she's from, but she was saying, of course, it's a fight against imperialism also. I would add to this, it's a fight for the people that have the right to be master of their own liberty and their own culture and to repossess their schools, which they have been dispossessed by companies and capital who want to use these schools as a tool to stimulate corporations. So people are fighting to repossess the substance of their very living collective life. I think that's what we're doing today.
And as we're here, Jean Charest is in Paris. And I wonder if you see a connection there.
Well, I think that Mr. Charest is showing contempt to the students by not being here. And the ministers are also showing contempt by not listening to all the students and the teachers in the streets today. And I think this government will have a bad surprise. If they keep up this attitude, it will keep rising the movement. They will have to listen.
Now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Dee LaConte has been working in community radio programming since the late 90s in her role as the host of Prison Radio, broadcasted at CKUT in Montreal. Carly Forbes and Shabina Lafleur-Genje bring us an interview with Dee at the Breaking Bars Building Bridges Conference in Waterloo.
My name is Dee LaConte, and I'm the host of the Prison Radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I've been producing radio for this show as well as the show prior to that, Criminal Injustice, on CKUT since the late 90s. So it's pretty well the majority of all recordings that I've done for the radio station has been in regards to the various issues on incarceration and how that affects the inside and outside communities.
Would you like to talk a bit about how you got started in prison radio?
Well, in the beginning, with there was the show Criminal Injustice. There were a couple of folks that I knew that started it up. Oddly enough, it was I was one of the people being interviewed after a big arrest that had taken place. It was a big mass arrest, and I was one of the people. And so I was interviewed shortly after. I just got home just after being, gotten released out of jail. And so I was very impressed with their work as well, criminal injustice. They did a lot in regards to political prisoners and things like this. And I was already doing prison, anti-prison activism, anti-police brutality activism around that time. And it's, after a short period of time, they asked, would you like to come, you and your, you know, other activist friends that I was hanging out with at that time? And we were doing every fourth show. Now, this was a very short show. It was like half hour every 2 weeks. So it'd be like every second month, more or less, that we'd put on a show. But we did. And then after about a year or so later, they were overextended because of all the work that they were doing, and as well as all the activism they were doing and everything. So they wanted to drop the show, and we said, no, we want to keep it. So we kept it, and we kept on going and going. I mean, there was always things to report on. It was a little bit harder maybe to find stuff as it is today. You know, we didn't have internet, or internet was a very, very new thing, and you know, it didn't really, you know, download audio and things like that. But there was so much local repression, and also there's so many things to learn about and to interview people that would come in town that would do talks in regards to whether that be political prisoners in the traditional sense, or whether just looking at the whole, you know, prison industrial complex and everything. There was a bit of censorship at CQT at that time, I felt, and there was a lot of antagonism. It wasn't so easy to get the show originally off the ground. I'd found out from the founders of the show, they really had to really try to sell their product. It wasn't like, and at that time, the station was organized in a different manner, much more of a top-down manner than more as, like nowadays, it's more like, there are people that are workers there and do get paid. However, they have a lot of respect for all the volunteers and the different community groups and activist groups and et cetera that, you know, do things in the community. And also, and they're very much into bringing that community into the airways. And they also believe now, like, it, when it made all these changes. And I'd like to give thanks to Gretchen King, who was with the station for 10 years, because she was instrumental in my way of thinking, because she met me when I had left the station because I was fed up, because I was being censored. And there was a lot of different, I won't go into too many details, but there was a lot of different stuff that took place. The prison radio show, she found an area to have a slot, then there was another slot. So we have like two different time slots, so two different hours. But always encouraged also that to put those issues in other shows as well. Like if a musician, say, is going to be censored or thrown in prison, why not do something like that on a music show? If there's a transgendered person who's being locked up and unduly incarcerated, why not put that on a queer show, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That was Carly Forbes and Shabina Lafleur-Ganger speaking with Dee LeConte for Groundwire.
I'm Leanne Arneson.
And I'm Carla Green.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CKUT in Montreal, thanks for tuning in.
Music this week was by Ariane Moffat. Headlines this week were written by Aaron Lakoff and Christiane Leprec. We would also like to thank Trevor Chow-Fraser, Jen Bieber, Catherine Fisher, Dee LeConte, David Tassiam, Carly Forbes, and Shabina Lafleur-Ganger.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.